What happens when a financial model built on a century of bond-derived mathematics encounters a business that grows at 15% a year without spending a single dollar to do so?
Well, the model breaks.
Right. The spreadsheet physically cannot divide by zero. And in that mathematical fracture lies, I mean, perhaps the most significant structural undervaluation in modern equity markets. Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are looking at a fundamental blind spot in Wall Street's math. We are breaking down the averaging up framework, drawing specifically on the foundational principles from the margin of safety to the free growth premium. We are going to explore why the most sophisticated analysts in the world are routinely mispricing modern compounding machines.
The mission of this video is to really trace the DNA of our current financial models. Because, you know, if you want to understand why a modern valuation model fails, you have to look at the world it was engineered for.
Which was an industrial reality?
Exactly. It was built for a reality where corporate growth always demanded capital. By analyzing that evolution, we can see exactly why today's zero marginal cost businesses are fundamentally misunderstood.
To understand the failure of the modern spreadsheet, you first have to understand its architect, Benjamin Graham. Now, he was not initially an equity analyst, right? His foundation was fixed income.
Yes. He spent his formative years on Wall Street in the 1910s analyzing bonds. So the concept that completely defines him, the margin of safety, is fundamentally a bond concept translated into stocks.
How did that pure mechanic work in his mind?
Well, think about a bond. It has a known face value, say $1,000. If you purchase that bond at $700, your margin of safety is $300.
Right. The coupon is fixed.
Exactly. And the maturity is a contractual certainty. The primary variable you are assessing is simply the risk of default. It is an analytical framework engineered for an asset that possesses a known floor and, crucially, entirely lacks growth. Graham took this fixed income architecture and mapped it straight onto the equity markets.
He essentially translated the face value of the bond into the liquidation value of a company.
Yes. He asked, if you shuttered the business tomorrow, sold off the tangible assets, you know, the locomotives, the steel, the real estate, what was the actual cash value?
And the margin of safety became the mathematical distance between the stock's market price and that tangible breakup value. But we have to view this through the macroeconomic lens of the 1930s.
Absolutely. Graham was analyzing heavy manufacturing, railroads, steel mills. In that era, the A, which we will define as the toll, the mechanism that collects current revenue, was entirely physical. It was blast furnaces.
And inventory.
Right. But the B, the growth of the enterprise, was highly suspect. Growth required massive capital expenditures, new factories, flawless management execution, and immense physical labor.
It was a fragile promise. It could easily fail.
Which is why Graham's cardinal rule was absolute. Never pay for the B. You pay strictly for the A, the tangible toll, and you demand a discount on its liquidation value.
The safety resided entirely in the discount, never in the growth. And, I mean, in a world where every business was mechanical, where growth consumed enormous amounts of capital, distrusting the B was the only rational posture. He built the correct mathematical framework for the physical constraints of his time.
But Graham's model had an inherent limitation. What happens when a company actually uses its cash to build a better engine instead of just sitting on it as tangible equity?
That is where Philip Fisher completely inverts the math. Where Graham demanded that you never pay for the B, Fisher argued that the B is the only variable that truly matters. He insisted that you must pay for growth.
And pay generously, because Fisher recognized a critical inefficiency in how capital was extracted from a business, specifically the friction of the dividend.
That taxation aspect.
Exactly. When a corporation distributes a dollar as a dividend, that dollar is immediately subjected to taxation. You, the shareholder, are then forced to take whatever remains and reinvest it at the prevailing market rate, maybe 8 or 10%.
But if that dollar is retained inside a superior business and reinvested internally at 20%, it compounds uninterrupted. The friction of extraction destroys value.
While reinvestment at the source creates it, Fisher was analyzing the great industrial growth engines of his day. Companies like Motorola, Dow Chemical, Texas Instruments.
These corporations reinvested heavily in research and development and new manufacturing capabilities. That growth, the B, was incredibly expensive. Every dollar of expansion was purchased by a dollar of reinvested capital.
Yes, but Fisher gladly paid a premium for it because the internal return on that reinvestment vastly exceeded the cost. He broke away from Graham's static bond analogy. A bond cannot retain its coupon and internally compound it at 20%.
Fisher sought perpetual compounders. But, and I think this is vital to understand, the bee Fisher paid for remained strictly mechanical.
It did. It still required capital, engineers, and product cycles. He optimized the mechanical bee, but he did not transcend it.
Which inevitably leads us to Warren Buffett and the synthesis of these two opposing views. Guided by Charlie Munger, Buffett fused Graham's rigorous price discipline with Fisher's profound appreciation for durable, compounding growth.
And Buffett introduced two critical concepts that advance the framework. The first is the equity coupon.
Right.
The Coca-Cola example.
Exactly. When Buffett acquired his massive position in Coca-Cola in 1988, the earnings per share were 36 cents. A decade later, they were $1.42. He conceptualized the business as a bond where the coupon systematically increases.
You receive the security of fixed income fused with the aggressive appreciation of equity. And the second concept, heavily influenced by Fisher, was look-through earnings.
Yes. Buffett instructed his shareholders to ignore Berkshire Hathaway's dividend, which is purposely zero. Instead, you measure your wealth by calculating your proportional share of the retained earnings of every operating business Berkshire owns.
So the visible dividend is zero, but the invisible compounding happening behind the corporate veil is massive.
Which gives us Buffett's 15-15 benchmark. A superior business, in this synthesized framework, compounds its book value, its net asset value, at 15% per year, with earnings expanding in lockstep.
15% return on equity, paired with 15% growth. The flywheel is intact and highly efficient. Let me synthesize this arrow with an analogy to clarify the physical constraints of these models. Graham bought the industrial engine purely for its scrap metal value. Fisher paid a premium for a larger, more powerful engine. Buffett bought a highly efficient engine that fueled itself, but the underlying physics remained identical, right? Every engine still required fuel. Growth still required capital.
That is the definitive characteristic of the 20th century compounding machine. Even for an exceptional business like Coca-Cola, the equity coupon only grew because the corporation spent billions on global marketing and distribution infrastructure. The flywheel required constant, massive infusions of financial fuel.
Now, let us examine the fundamental rupture in this century-long intellectual tradition. We are moving from an era where growth required fuel to an era where growth became entirely exogenous and free. We are entering the era of what this framework calls the free surfer.
To observe this shift, consider the major initial public offerings of the early 2000s. Visa in 2008, MSCI in 2007, S&P Global spun off in 2013.
When these entities entered the public markets, institutional investors priced them as mechanical toll collectors. I mean, Visa had spent 50 years operating as a highly mechanical business.
Yes, negotiating banking agreements country by country, physically installing merchant terminals. Their growth was real, but it was purchased.
Terminal by terminal, contract by contract.
Exactly. But the transition to a free surfer did not happen on the day of their IPOs. It emerged as the macroeconomic environment shifted entirely around them. The smartphone was introduced, global e-commerce accelerated.
Suddenly, the cost of processing a marginal digital transaction collapsed towards zero.
The wave, the digitalization of global payments, became an exogenous force. Visa no longer had to build the infrastructure. Apple built it, Square built it, Shopify built it. The growth wave arrived uninvited and, crucially, without cost to Visa.
Let us unpack that metaphor for a moment because it is central to understanding the framework.
Yeah.
Think of it literally like a surfer in the ocean. The surfer does not generate the wave.
No, they do not spend calories or money to make the water move.
Right. The ocean, in this case, the macroeconomic trend of digitalization, does all the heavy lifting. The surfer simply builds the board, which is the toll, and positions themselves perfectly to ride it.
That is the correct visualization. And we saw the identical structural shift with MSCI. For 40 years, they sold data subscriptions to active fund managers, which is a classic mechanical business-to-business sales model.
Then the exchange-traded fund revolution materialized.
Passive investing expanded from 10% of the market to over 50%. Every dollar that systematically migrated from active to passive management triggered an automatic zero-cost licensing fee to MSCI.
S&P Global rode a similar exogenous wave. The digitalization of credit markets made the distribution of ratings instantaneous, while post-crisis regulatory frameworks made those ratings mandatory. The expansion of global credit became a structural free wave. But wait, if you are listening to this, you should be asking a critical question. If the fundamental nature of their growth transitioned from purchase to free, why didn't institutional discounted cash flow models recalibrate? Why did Wall Street continue applying Graham and Buffett's mechanical math to a natural phenomenon.
Because institutional models are inherently rigid. They are mathematical constructs built to measure the physics of the 20th century.
A standard discounted cash flow model, a DCF, is programmed on a fundamental assumption, right?
Yes. The assumption that a corporation must retain and deploy capital to generate future cash. The spreadsheet physically cannot comprehend a business architecture that expands organically without retaining capital for reinvestment.
We need to deconstruct how these modern businesses actually operate using the vocabulary of the averaging up framework. In the mechanical world we just discussed, a business is A plus B, the toll plus the growth.
Yes, and because growth costs capital, the toll and the growth are in constant competition for the same dollar of cash flow. If you want more B, you must sacrifice some of your A to pay for it.
But in the free surfer architecture, the toll, which is A, and the wave, which is B, multiply. It is A times B.
Because the wave delivers the growth for free, the toll retains 100% of its cash flow.
The enterprise simultaneously compounds its intrinsic value and returns all of its cash to shareholders, which in Grammer Fisher's mechanical world is a physical impossibility. Growth always consumed the cash that could otherwise be returned.
The framework defines this specific architecture as double naturality. It is arguably the rarest and most potent structural advantage in modern markets.
So double naturality simply means the moat protecting the business is natural, meaning it is self-reinforcing without human intervention, and the growth is also natural, driven by structural zero-cost waves.
Exactly.
Let us examine that first half, the natural moat. If this growth is completely free, what is stopping a competitor from just jumping on the exact same wave? The framework uses a concept called the hierarchy of moats to explain this defense.
Right, because not all defensive barriers are created equal. At the base, you have sand moats, which are purely regulatory.
They can dissolve overnight by a single legislative decree.
Precisely. Above that are mechanical moats, which are technological or industrial. They are strong, but they must be continuously rebuilt and funded in every new product cycle.
And at the apex?
At the apex, you find coral moats.
A coral moat is essentially a network effect, but how does that work in practice? Take Visa, for example.
Well, like a coral reef, Visa's network grows stronger and more calcified simply through usage. Every consumer who carries a Visa card makes the network more valuable to a merchant.
And every merchant who accepts Visa makes the card more valuable to the consumer.
Yes, this dual-sided network strengthens itself organically. It requires zero maintenance capital to sustain that defense. The free surfer operates exclusively behind a coral moat.
And then we have the growth side of the equation, the wave. The framework borrows a highly sophisticated metric from fixed income analysis called dual duration to evaluate this. It looks at two variables. When does the cash arrive, and who precisely controls its arrival?
In mechanical equities, duration is often singular and controlled by management. The executives forecast demand and decide when to allocate capital to build the new factory.
But in a free surfer, the duration is dual and multiplicative.
Exactly. You possess the short-term certainty of the immediate toll collection every single time a credit card is swiped, combined with the long-duration compounding of the structural wave.
And critically, that wave is driven by massive global macroeconomic behavior, not by internal management forecasts. Which leads us directly to the central paradox of the spreadsheet. If you are a financial analyst, you rely on a metric called return on invested capital, or ROIC, to measure efficiency. You divide the profit by the capital it costs to generate it.
But if a corporation's growth costs absolutely zero, the denominator in that calculation is zero.
And mathematically, dividing by zero results in infinity. You end up with analysts staring at divide by zero errors on their screens. The spreadsheet breaks.
And instead of realizing the model is broken, the market assumes the company must simply be overvalued.
This is exactly where Graham's century-old margin of safety inverts, doesn't it?
It does. Graham sought safety in a discount to tangible physical liquidation value. A free surfer possesses almost no physical assets to liquidate. Its entire value resides in its invisible network and its trust standard. Therefore, Graham's metric is entirely blind to it.
Instead, we observe the emergence of the free growth premium. The margin of safety is no longer found in a discount to scrap metal. The safety resides in the profound structural undervaluation of invisible zero-cost growth.
The market fails to price the asset correctly because the model demands a risk premium for growth, failing to recognize that this specific growth carries less risk than the foundational business itself.
Think about the cash flows of a highly entrenched free surfer riding a structural macroeconomic wave. The certainty of Visa capturing its fraction of a cent on global commerce over the next 20 years may, in fact, present less long-term uncertainty than a 30-year United States Treasury bond.
Yet the institutional model forces the analyst to apply a standard equity discount rate. The model fractures at the exact point where the empirical truth of the free surfer begins.
But we need to transition from theoretical frameworks to empirical market action. Theories are elegant, but we must observe where highly sophisticated capital is actually migrating. This brings us to a concept called the gradient.
To observe the gradient in action, look at the public filings of Chris Hahn. He manages over $50 billion.
If you review his 13F filings, which are basically the mandatory quarterly scorecard showing exactly what massive institutional funds are buying and selling, a distinct structural migration of capital becomes evident over consecutive quarters.
He systematically liquidated positions in exceptionally high-quality mechanical businesses, entities like Canadian Railways and GE Aerospace.
Now, these are not bad companies. They are companies with profound mechanical moats. They are the absolute apex of the A plus B architecture. Yet, he sold them to aggressively accumulate positions in Visa, S&P Global, and Moody's.
This is the empirical manifestation of the gradient. It is the structural, unidirectional migration of capital ascending the hierarchy of quality.
To put it simply, we are seeing the smartest money in the world moving in a one-way street.
Moving away from A plus B, where growth demands billions of dollars per cycle, and migrating toward A times B, where growth is exogenous and free.
It is important to observe that Hahn does not use the vocabulary of double naturality or the free surfer in his investor letters. He doesn't need to. The framework simply provides the exact nomenclature for what his capital already recognizes. The discriminant is the cost of the B.
Right. He is systematically selling excellent businesses to purchase superior architectures, governed entirely by the capital intensity of their growth. His actions prove the thesis.
The broader market, in aggregate, may rely on broken spreadsheets, but apex capital allocators act as if the gradient is an absolute law of financial physics. They recognize that the ultimate discriminator of terminal value is the presence of a zero-cost wave.
As we synthesize this century-long trajectory from Graham's tangible assets to Fisher's reinvestment engines and finally to the free surfer, a critical point must be established regarding intellectual history. Graham, Fisher, and Buffett did not miss the A times B architecture due to a lack of intellect.
No, they missed it due to strict chronology. You can only analyze the phenomena that your specific era produces. In the 1930s, the concept of a business expanding without capital expenditure was not merely a blind spot, it was a physical impossibility.
Visa required the global saturation of the smartphone. MSCI required the mathematical certainty of the passive indexation trend. None of these macroeconomic conditions existed during the formative years of the 20th century masters.
The world must first produce the business. The business then reveals the underlying concept. The concept necessitates the creation of a new framework.
And that framework finally assigns a precise vocabulary to phenomena that the traditional spreadsheet is entirely blind to.
And we are remarkably early in this specific chronology. The structural wave carrying Visa has digitalized roughly 15% of global transactions. The vast majority of the global economy remains analog.
The migration toward passive indexation carrying MSCI has perhaps another decade of structural runway before encountering any theoretical ceiling. The globalization of credit markets is irreversible. These zero-cost waves have decades left to compound.
Which leaves you with a final, vital consideration. If legacy platforms like Morningstar are still valuing Visa with the exact same discount rate and wide moat label as a traditional pharmaceutical company like Johnson & Johnson, well, what other zero-cost growth engines are currently hiding in plain sight, miscategorized by a spreadsheet that is blind to the modern physics of compounding? To explore these investment strategies further and discover more from the collection, visit the website averagingup.com.